loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories. In the first half hour, we have In the News, where we examine and review the big news stories of the week so far. And then in our second half hour, we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Special Counsel Robert Mueller has told the federal courts that he is no longer obliged to maintain the plea agreement with Paul Manafort. Mueller asserts that Manafort has violated the agreement by lying to the special counsel. Today, there are headlines proclaiming this to be true because his legal team spoke with President Trump's, but the two legal teams have a defense agreement authorizing this. It's a common communication tool that the two parties have had in place for a long time. Next, Guardian reporter Luke Harding made news yesterday when he reported from Quito, Ecuador, that Paul Manafort had met three times with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Manafort and Assange both denied the report, and The Guardian has begun editing and softening the article's original language. But who is Luke Harding, and why would he report something that just simply isn't true? Then, President Trump gave an interview to the Washington Post yesterday in which he threatened to cancel a meeting with Vladimir Putin and urged European countries to maintain a hostile posture toward Russia. Trump also railed against the Federal Reserve's chairman, Jerome Powell, and the interest rate policies that the Fed has been pursuing. And then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has named former Wall Street Journal editorial writer Mary Kissel as his new senior policy advisor for strategic messaging. It's not unusual that a journalist would enter the State Department, and it actually happens all the time. But in 2016, Kissel went on MSNBC's Morning Joe to call Donald Trump, quote, frighteningly ignorant, unquote, and to say that he had, quote, no principles and no policies, unquote. Trump responded by tweeting that Kissel was a major loser, exclamation point. And finally, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said yesterday that the UK Integrity Initiative is a British government-sponsored front organization aimed at defaming the Russian government. The UK Integrity Initiative purported to be an independent watchdog organization until hackers from the group Anonymous found documents proving that it was created by British intelligence. And in other headlines, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani named a 12-person team for potential peace talks with the Taliban today. The team will be led by Ghani's chief of staff, Abdusalam Rahimi. Meanwhile, the Taliban claimed an attack that killed 10 people in Kabul today. Denmark's Danske Bank had, quote, preliminary charges, unquote, filed against it today for money laundering. Officials are examining transactions involving 200 billion euros, or about $230 billion, that went through the bank's Estonian unit between 2007 and 2015. They're focusing on 15,000 non-resident clients. Energy Transfer LP and its Sunoco pipeline subsidiary, while building two of the country's biggest natural gas pipelines, have accumulated over 800 state and federal permit violations. According to Reuters, four similar pipeline projects each got 19 violations. The pipelines are Energy Transfer Rover and Sunoco Mariner East 2, and they carry gas from Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres today urged attendees of the UN climate conference taking place next week to prepare to iron out a deal to implement the Paris Climate Accord. Guterres said, quote, leadership is to understand that the agreement is the most important objective. That, more than to be very stubborn in staying in each one's position, unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
It's Wednesday, which means we turn, as we do every Wednesday now, in this new weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Jacqueline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot to talk about. Again, we're at the end of the week. We do the week in review with you.
Right.
And that segment is an hour long. It happens every, if you're listening live to Loud and Clear, it's between 4 and 5 p.m. every Friday at SputnikNews.com or at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM. But we take a look in this segment of stories that are already kind of big stories. And there's a number of them. There was, of course, the election in Mississippi. Let's talk about that.
I don't know how many times I feel like a broken record, and I have no problem telling people I told you so. But I told you so. I mean, white supremacy is a problem in this country that we continue to ignore. Then we are surprised when candidates running for office, and not just in southern states with a history of racism, run for office, say racist things, and still get elected. Listen, I don't care how large the black voter population is in Mississippi and Alabama or Georgia or Florida. If more white people vote for racist politicians will always win. That's the demographics are always just in favor of the people who just outnumber the people that everyone else continues to want to save them. We can't keep expecting black voters to save this country from horrible politicians.
And the horrible politician I think you're referring to might be Cindy Hyde-Smith, the victor in the senatorial race in Mississippi. Let's just help the audience understand who she is and why she deserves this label of white supremacy.
Well, the two main issues, a lot of people paid attention to a couple of weeks ago when she said that if someone invited her to a public hanging, she would be there at the front row. She was out making a, you know, at a campaign speech extolling the virtues of whoever this person was. I don't even remember who the person was. Just the fact that a white woman in Mississippi with the history of lynching that it has said publicly that if another white person invited her to a public hanging, she would be in the front row. Her opponent was a black man. That's one issue. And of course, everybody tried to make it seem like she didn't say anything wrong. Interestingly enough, so did some black conservatives in the state. And that's an interesting dynamic there. But that comes from the whole indoctrination of the moral majority from Jerry Falwell and Liberty University and the Southern Baptist Convention and that kind of thing that has really damaged the black church, especially in the South. But then there's a lesser issue that people didn't know as much about where she posed, I think, a couple of years ago for a picture at the Confederate Museum in Mississippi. And she posed with a Confederate era musket gun with a Confederate cap on her head. And the caption under the picture was, you know, this is the telling the history of Mississippi at its finest.
Yeah, Mississippi proud.
So this is the person who has said these things and done these things that Mississippians, that white Mississippians just elected.
May I add something to that, too? There was
Please.
A terrific discussion this morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe about Cindy Hyde-Smith. And a Republican consultant was talking about her. And she said that Cindy Hyde-Smith is also very simply a lightweight. She's a nobody. You know, on Capitol Hill, there are show horses and there are work horses. She's neither one. She's unqualified. She's not very bright. She's not even a very good campaigner.
No.
I mean, this is Mississippi. Anybody, even somebody half brain dead with an R after his name, is going to win that Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
And she barely won it. I mean, by Mississippi standards, she barely won it.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, the population is 60% or 61% white, 39% African-American. For Mike Espy, the Democrat who served in the Clinton administration, to get 46% of the total vote meant that some minority of white people actually did vote for Mike Espy. And I just wonder, Jackie, if because I haven't been to Mississippi in a long time, I'm not really that familiar with the politics. I know I've been following what's going on in Jackson, Mississippi, because a predominantly black city, a lot of grassroots organizing, real, novel, radical sort of black self-determination politics, along with an effort to build a rainbow coalition, including progressive whites and progressive Latinos. I know a little bit about that, but what do you make of the fact that it was as close as it became? Again, it was 53% to 46%. Given Hyde-Smith's reputation and record as a white supremacist, clearly she should have gotten very, very few votes. So the fact that she won as you're pointing out, highly significant in terms of the enduring problem of white supremacy amongst a very, very large part of the white population in Mississippi. But do you discern any trends, any change happening?
I think the fact that Espy did get the percentage of vote that he got, and that had to have been bolstered by a much more significant percentage of white voters than I expected, actually. That's good. That's a good thing, because that was a good showing by him. And it helps that he actually does have some pretty solid policy bona fides. I mean, he has the experience. You know, we can talk about his involvement in the Clinton, you know, administration. That's a whole nother discussion. But even Espy had been subjected to some pretty shoddy treatment by Clinton.
Clinton walked away from him in light of a scandal that took place near the tail end of the administration.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all this other stuff going on that a lot of people probably don't know about. But what they do know, the people who voted for Mike Espy, was that they were willing to move Mississippi in a different direction from where Mississippi has always been, which is where Hyde Smith is going to continue to keep them. It just wasn't enough people. It just wasn't enough people this time. But I think this is a solid foundation to build on. I think Hyde Smith's, she's going to have a disastrous run. It's going to be bad. Like you said, John, she's a lightweight. She doesn't know what she's doing. It's all, what is it, flash and no substance. And the flash is dull. So not expecting anything great out of Mississippi under her leadership.
Well, we've experienced what people in Mississippi have experienced is that there is a kind of a political tyranny that rules. If you buck the tide of racism, and that's the issue, that's the defining issue. If you buck the tide of racism, if you're black and you stand up, then you're going to be targeted, perhaps.
Yes.
That's the history of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. If you're white and you want to come out against racism, you will also be targeted by the racists. They don't want white people standing up and saying, hey, you know what? I reject racism. That is actually a lethal danger for these racists. And so there is the lynch mob, which we know about, and thousands of people, black people, you know, burned and mutilated and hung and killed. I mean, we know about that. But there's that other kind of lynch mob, which is the social pressure on people to conform.
Yes.
Very powerful. Mm-hmm. That's why if there's any new development in Mississippi, maybe it started in Jackson with the election of Chukwue Lumumba and the coalition that he and those who were aligned with him have been able to build and sustain, whatever its contradictions. Maybe that's a sign that Mississippi is changing. And maybe, just maybe, this election campaign, even though she won, maybe it is an indicator that change is coming to Mississippi. It needs to come because guess what? Racism, which has terrorized the black population in Mississippi, has also made Mississippi one of the poorest states, if not the poorest state in the country.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. You have that old Bob Dylan song, Only a Pawn in Their Game, about white people who line up behind white racist, white supremacist, Klansmen, think, hey, I'm different, I'm white. Guess what? You end up just being a pawn in the game of rich white politicians and their operatives.
That's exactly it. And I think that you are absolutely right. I think Chukwue Lumumba's win and his work is energizing a new generation of activists across the state. I think he gave people the courage to say, you know what? Yeah, we can stand up and we can fight. We can, and I know, you know, for people who do not live in that environment, that's a weird thing to say, where, you know, we're always at protests here in D.C. and we're always,
it's easy here.
It's easy here. In the South, it's an entirely different environment. That social pressure that you talk about to not make waves, to not make the people you work for and work with angry because they will retaliate against you. That's still a very real thing that a lot of poor people, black people and our allies live with every day in the South. But people eventually get tired of being oppressed like that. So I think this might be the last gasp of a Republican Senate candidate out of Mississippi.
Before we go on to another story, John, I want to just share an anecdote, and because I want to pick up on Jackie's point about it's easy to demonstrate in Washington or San Francisco or New York.
Right.
But when you're in the South and in the Deep South, so-called, it's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. It really is a different thing. And I had the experience of going with people from Atlanta, Georgia to Decatur, Alabama in June 1979, because the week before, the Klan had opened fire on a Southern Christian Leadership Conference march, and a bunch of people were shot.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some young Vietnam veterans, African-American guys, who were in a pickup truck. They came up and they shot at the Klan, and they shot into the Klan. And there were four or five people shot on both sides. And there was a demonstration called the next week by Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And the Klan said, we're going to mobilize too. And they did. There was tons of them. So I came to Decatur, Alabama, which is northern Alabama. At the beginning of the march, the organizers from SCLC, that's Martin Luther King's organization. Now, he's already dead. It's 11 years later. They say, anybody with a gun, come into the church and drop off your gun. We'll tag it and you can get it at the end of the demonstration. But we don't want to have our side have guns. And so there was about four or five guys came into the church, dropped off their gun. And then I saw the SCLC leadership huddling on the porch of this church. And they then made an announcement. All men come forward into the church. And everybody had a gun. And everybody had to register their gun. So we couldn't march for another hour because everybody brought guns. This was Southern Christian Leadership Conference, nonviolent organization. That's how it is in the South. You don't want to go to a demonstration without a gun in Decatur, Alabama, when the Klan is mobilizing. That was the reality. And people in big cities in the North, they don't know about this.
Yeah. I mean, and the entire, I think this segues into another kind of topic that where there is this tension between black people and black progressives and white progressives. It's the issue of guns. I mean, there is that issue of historical violence, especially in the South, that black people have had to defend ourselves against. And especially after World War One, when so many black veterans came back from the war, they defended their communities from racist mobs of white people who were angry that black veterans came back expecting to be treated like American citizens.
Like first-class citizens.
Exactly. So, you know, these black men took their weapons that they brought back from the war with them and their knowledge of how to use them and defended their families. So this is a very long history of Second Amendment right exercising among black people. That's still kind of a thorny issue, but especially in the South, you also have the hunting culture, right? Which is, I mean, my family owns guns. My dad owns guns. My grandmother owns guns. We own guns because we live near the woods and it would be nothing to open the back door to the house and see a bear peeking out, you know, or a fox. And you don't want to hope that they're not sick and that they're more afraid of you than you are of them. So there's, you know, and you know, people hunt for food. But then there is also the old boys network where you've got, especially in rural areas, where people live on isolated back roads. And there are not many people who live on those back roads. And if someone comes to your home causing trouble, if you call the police, it might take the police 15, 20 minutes to get there. So what do you do in the meantime?
And if you're a person in a rural area and you happen to be black, the police might come and just be part of the problem, not the solution.
Exactly. So this is like decades of these different realities that we've been living with in the South, because I'm from the South. So black people owning guns, that's not like a, we're not conflicted about that in the South.
Right, right. Let's go on to another story. Before we do, I want to just make one little mention, again, along what Jackie Lookman is talking about. If you go about a mile north of where we are to the Howard Theater, there's a plaque in front of the Howard Theater Florida, and it commemorates the black veterans who returned from World War One, who set up a sniper post at the top of Howard Theater to try to disperse a racist white mobs that were beating and killing black people in Washington, D.C. That was in 1919.
Mm-hmm.
These were the returning veterans. Same thing happened after World War II. There were a lot of murders, really lynchings of black soldiers who came back in the South, who came back with the idea You can't be a first-class soldier and come back to be a second-class citizen.
Absolutely
so
right.
So people were not going to bow again. And as a consequence, once they got back to the Deep South, which would be, well, Malcolm X said it was anywhere south of the Canadian-U.S. border. But, you know, when you got back to these areas, people murdered them. I mean, they were murdered because they were strong and defiant and had just gone through a war, fought to defend their country against a power that, you know, espoused racial supremacy theories. That would be Hitler. They came back and said, no, we're not fighting over there in Europe against white supremacy and racial supremacy and coming back and living it. And a lot of those people, one, were targeted by the racists, and two, a lot of those people became really the facilitators of that next wave of the civil rights movement, late 1940s, 1950s, Rosa Parks, that whole milieu in Alabama, Mississippi. A lot of those folks, those young, mostly men coming back from the war, played a major, major role.
Absolutely. I mean, this whole history that we don't know because we're not taught it in schools, right? And that's all of us. It all feeds into what happened in this election in Mississippi, and to a large degree, what happened in Florida, what happened in Georgia, and this idea that white people, as Bernie Sanders said, I still criticize him for saying it, that some white people are uncomfortable voting for black people for the first time in their lives, but that doesn't mean that they're racist. Well,
yes, it does.
How does that mean you're not racist if it bothers you that much not to cast your vote for someone solely because of the color of their skin? So this is what we've lived with all this time. So there is nothing that happens in electoral politics when it comes to these kinds of issues that isn't framed in the context of race. It's impossible to look at it.
That's a good segue to go to another issue, which I think is basically also the issue of race, which is what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border in this week. Now, tear gas, CS tear gas, CN tear gas, banned by the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention for warfare, is being used routinely against civilians in different countries, including it was used in Ferguson.
Yep.
When the black community rose up following the killing of Mike Brown. It was used this week against children, babies, their mothers, their fathers. What about that?
This use of chemical weapons against oppressed people is a common tactic of empire, right? When empire is challenged, they'll do whatever they can to quell the opposition. And even if it means literally waging war against the civilian resistance, and that's all this is. I mean, I think part of this discussion that sort of disturbs me a little bit is that people don't seem to realize that this is not a new thing, using tear gas against immigrants at the U.S. border. This was done under the Obama administration. I mean, so this is not something that, you know, Trump is doing, so, you know, he's particularly more evil. No, this is an issue of empire that has destroyed the countries of brown people and is now punishing those people because they've decided that their lives are really just not worth treating like human beings.
It was my understanding, too, that technically the use of tear gas internationally is illegal. It's a violation of the chemical weapons.
In warfare.
Yeah. But it's not illegal to use it on your own people or in your own country.
And that, I think, is insane. And to me, that's another kind of imperialist justification that makes no sense. If chemical warfare is illegal in combat, what changes that makes it okay to use it, like, say, in Ferguson or at the U.S. border? What are the dynamics of the people who will be on the receiving end that of those chemical weapons that makes it okay to use domestically, but I can't use it if I'm going to war with, say, Russia?
And to make the situation worse, there was reporting this week that Kristen Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security, wanted to create a database to track children who were migrant children who were separated from their parents. And Donald Trump personally denied permission to create such a database. It went up through the chain of command at the White House, and he personally said there will be no such database.
This whole issue of the Latin American economic crisis, because that's what this is. This is not, you know, like violent gangs of people escaping Honduras and Nicaragua. This isn't MS-13 trying to break into our country. This is the result of U.S. foreign policy that has destabilized these countries in the Latin cone and in Latin America, Honduras, Nicaragua, since 1980 and probably before. Since this goes back to Iran-Contra and probably before then, this ridiculous fight that the United States government has had against quote-unquote communism or quote-unquote socialism, when a democratically elected leader of a foreign country takes office and says, I want to nationalize the profits from the resources of this country so that our people can benefit from these resources. And we are going to develop a socialist system so that benefits are equally distributed to everyone. And the United States government loses its mind because it has this ridiculous white supremacist Red Scare mentality that they must stop communism from spreading.
Well, we've learned in the last 2 years that it was Russia and the Kremlin that actually created the socially divisive issue of racism in America.
Yes. Vladimir Putin is a genius for creating something that we've been living with for 400 years.
I think he started the African slave trade.
I think he made the British do it.
And the Spanish and the Portuguese. Anyway, we're completely out of time. Joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. You'll hear Jackie again with us this Friday between 4 and 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM, or SputnikNews.com, where we take a look at the week in review, the big issues of the week. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined, as we are every Wednesday, by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Kevin Camps, Nicole, welcome back.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kevin, you're not here in the studio with us. You're in a winter wonderland somewhere else. Where are you?
I'm in Kalamazoo, Michigan, my hometown, and everything has 2 inches of snow, every twig, every branch. It's beautiful.
Oh my gosh, it's still fall. How is that possible?
We got hit the other day, and it keeps on coming.
In Kalamazoo, fall doesn't mean you don't have snow.
Fall means you do have snow.
Yeah.
A friend of mine up in northern Michigan pointed out that we get 6 months of winter. And when I heard that, I was like, you know, that's true.
That's why I live in D.C.
Well, I grew up in Rochester, New York on Lake Ontario. And we did have 6 months of winter, except now it's not 6 months of winter. I don't know. I mean, we're...
I wonder why.
Anyway, that's another topic. Kevin Camps, let's get serious here. What's some of the big stories? Let's start with nuclear weapons and Iran and the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which the Trump administration is 100% committed to destroying.
Yeah, and the irony is, the hypocrisy is, that the United States, the Trump administration, certain elements of Congress, to be sure, are very interested in striking a nuclear agreement with Saudi Arabia, of all countries, including allowing Saudi Arabia to have uranium enrichment, which it could then use for nuclear weapons purposes, which its tyrant has said he would certainly do to counter Iran if necessary. So the double standards are pretty thick here. Iran is in compliance with the Iran nuclear deal, as has been verified by multiple parties. And as you said, the Trump administration can do nothing more than undermine the deal while flirting with Saudi Arabia. So it's pretty rank stuff.
You know, we have a situation where the European countries, who were the co-signers, it was five countries, the five members of the Security Council plus Germany. So it's the P5 plus one, and Iran signed this agreement. So it's a multilateral treaty. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran is complying. They're heavily inspected. They've shipped parts of their uranium or enhance uranium outside the country. It's a very, very tight regime of inspections and monitoring of Iran's nuclear program, civilian nuclear energy program, such that it would be not possible, at least in the short term, for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. And Iran says they don't want a nuclear weapon. They say, in fact, that it's against religion. They've issued a fatwa against it, a religious edict. But the European countries want this agreement. But the question is, how much do they want it? And more importantly, how much are they willing to stand up to the threats and bullying of the United States? I think that's what Iran is really insisting that Europe give an answer.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. And it's kind of wild when you look at the news today and you look at the news, what, 3 or 4 months ago, it's pretty much identical. Iran saying, you know, hey, we're maintaining the JCPOA. We're continuing to follow this agreement, the strictest nuclear agreement the world has ever seen. But for what, right? The U.S. has continued sanctions and Europe has rhetorically been with Iran, but hasn't necessarily been backing up their rhetoric with any actual action. So this week, you know, there was Ali Akbar Salehi, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, was quoted saying, if we cannot sell our oil and we don't enjoy financial transactions, then I don't think keeping the deal will benefit us anymore. I mean, I think that's pretty reasonable. I completely understand where they're coming from.
What does it mean? Go ahead, Kevin. What does it mean for them not to continue with the deal?
Well, they would be freed up to pursue their nuclear interests. They claim, as you've said, that they are peaceful in nature, that it's for electricity generation, it's for medical isotope production. There are others in the world who don't believe them, including Saudi Arabia and Israel and the United States. And so in that sense, it would be off to the races. We would have a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. The tyrant leading Saudi Arabia right now, the Crown Prince, has said that if Iran makes any moves in the nuclear direction, that Saudi Arabia will be in hot pursuit. So it would be another, you know, hot spot in the world to go with the Koreas, to go with China and Taiwan and many other places, making our world a very dangerous place.
I couldn't agree more, Kevin. I, you know, from the outset, we've talked about the JCPOA on the show, and it made no sense for anyone to pull out of this deal. And, you know, again, we're faced with Iran at the moment being the only partner who's actually still in it. So I think we all hope that something comes of that, but unclear if that'll happen.
Well, also the Iranian government and President Rouhani, who was the big advocate for this policy and staked his political career on this policy, he's looking pretty bad in one way, because the hardliners, so-called the principalists in Iran, those who said, why deal with the United States? Why deal with the United States? It can't be trusted. It overthrew our government, the Iranian government, in 1953. That's what it really wants to do once again, because we have a government that, unlike the Shah of Iran, which was imposed on us, imposed on we, the Iranian people, by the CIA and British intelligence after economic sanctions took their toll, we shouldn't go down this road. Don't negotiate with America. And Rouhani said, no, let's do it. It's worth it. We can have an agreement. It'll be guaranteed because it's a multilateral agreement. And then 2 years later, the U.S. has another election. And the next political leader, in this case, Donald J. Trump, says, no, we're not going to do it. I mean, it strengthens the hand of Rouhani's opponents. I wonder whether what room Rouhani and that wing of Iranian body politic has to maneuver. It would seem to me that the Iranian people, almost in total, would understand that they are, in fact, the victims of American bullying, whether they like or don't like the current government. Go ahead, Kevin.
It was such a remarkable deal. I speak of it in the past tense. I hope I'm wrong. But it was, as Nicole said, it was unprecedented access to Iran's nuclear facilities. And if the parties to the agreement wanted to investigate other places in Iran that were suspect, it was doable, because Iran could object, but the other parties to the agreement could outvote them pretty easily. So here you have Iran willing to open itself up in unprecedented ways to being inspected by, you know, adversaries, essentially, at least the U.S. and Britain in that category. And, you know, here is Saudi Arabia balking at having any inspections under its proposed nuclear agreement with the United States, including on uranium enrichment, which even the United Arab Emirates agreed to. So It's a pretty sad state of affairs, largely orchestrated by the Trump administration.
Saudi Arabia won't allow inspections. Guess who doesn't also allow any inspections? Guess who else doesn't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
That's right.
Is it Australia?
Israel. The only ones.
And Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. The French helped build them.
And then when apartheid was falling apart, the Israelis reportedly purchased all of South Africa's nuclear weapons.
That's amazing. I mean, I want to go back to some of the language from the Atomic Energy Organization leadership in Iran. This is, again, the person we mentioned earlier, Ali Akbar Salahi. He said the Islamic Republic could resume enriching uranium to 20% purity, seen well above the level suitable for fueling civilian power plants, if it fails to see the economic benefit of the 2015 deal. If we cannot sell our oil and if we don't enjoy financial transactions, then I don't think keeping the deal will benefit us anymore. That's what we talked about earlier. I will certainly pass a word of caution to her. That's Federica Mogherini, the EU foreign policy leader in Brussels. I think the period, this is the part I want to get to. I think the period of patience for our people, meaning the Iranian people, is getting more and more limited. We are running out of the assumed timeline, which was in terms of months. There's political pressure on the leadership in Iran, including the leadership that actually wants to maintain this deal, because the Iranian people are a proud people. They want to be self-determining. They don't want to be kicked around like this, humiliated like this on the international scene. It could absolutely have the impact of profoundly changing Iranian politics. Because guess what? If inflation is devaluing, as it is, the Iranian currency, if working class and poor and even middle class people can't have access to goods and services that they thought they should be and would have been otherwise entitled to, it's going to change politics in Iran. Now, Kevin, the Trump administration and Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, they're pretty sure that if the economy in Iran screams enough, if the people suffer enough, if they're denied food and medicine in sufficient magnitudes, then the people will rise up against the Iranian government. I think that's just ridiculous. I mean, if anything, that would draw the Iranian people closer to the government, because they realize that their government, the government that speaks in their name, has in fact told the truth about this.
And these are the same policymakers that we recycle administration after administration, who said that the Iraqi people would throw flowers at us when we crossed the border.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, there's 40,000 Americans who either died, that was 5,000 of them, or had life-changing injuries, because guess what? Iraqis and Iranians, even if they disagree with their government, they don't want to be kicked around and treated like colonial slaves, and they're just not going to be.
Absolutely. I wanted to bring in another country, too, kind of relatedly. North Korea, you know, we've obviously had a bunch of news over the last year or so about North Korea. We had the Trump had the summit with Kim. Kim and Moon have had several summits together. That's, of course, the leader, Kim, the leader of North Korea, and Moon, the leader of South Korea. But there is new news that Kim has expressed a willingness to allow inspectors into the main nuclear complex, the Yongbyon nuclear facilities. This is, again, you know, another kind of point that North Korea has been following up on the agreement that was made in Singapore at the summit. So, Kevin, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the North Korean agreement to allow inspectors into that main complex?
Well, it's a hopeful sign. It's remarkable that Kim reportedly made this offer to Moon in September, and only now, a couple months later, is it coming to light for the public to see. And, you know, it's hopeful. There's a real impasse going on with canceled meetings and non-responses between the U.S. and North Korea at this point. So one would hope that this would get the peace talks back underway.
And if this doesn't, I think what really will is that South Korean President Moon received a gift of peace puppies from the leader of North Korea, Kim, and they just had babies, and they're very sweet if you find photos of them online.
Okay, we're gonna deal with that in another segment, perhaps. I want to go back, though, because I think this is a serious topic about what's going on with North Korea. The Nikki Haley, Pompeo, the Democrats, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, liberal, conservative alike, they don't want this deal to go forward. And I think it's important. While North Korea is signaling that they're going to allow these inspections, I want to go back to the Singapore summit. The Singapore summit, you know, it's always decried by the critics here in America of any sort of peace deal with North Korea. And they say, well, the Singapore summit declaration was short on specifics. But I want to read a couple sentences of it because I think we have to understand the overarching dynamic if we're going to end up at a point of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Here's what the declaration says. Point number one, the lead point, the United States and the DPRK commit to establish new U.S. DPRK relations in accordance with the desire of the peoples of the two countries for peace and prosperity. Number two, the United States and the DPRK will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Point number three, reaffirming the April 27, 2018 Panmunjom Declaration, the DPRK commits to work towards complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And four, the United States and the DPRK commit to recovering POW MIA remains. So point number one, the reason this is important, point number one was to have better relations, to resume or to establish normal, that is, peaceful relations between the two countries. Number two, to create a peace regime on the peninsula. And only number three does it come to the point that the both sides commit to work towards the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That means there's an obligation not just from North Korea as point number three, but for all sides, including the United States, Kevin.
Right, with a mainstay of U.S. strategy in the region being nuclear-equipped stealth bomber technology based on Guam. So, you know, the hypocrisy comes up again that the North Koreans are being held to denuclearization, while the United States, which signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty 50 years ago, saying in good faith that it would seek to abolish its own nuclear arsenal, doesn't seem to be required to do that.
Yeah, John, you know, I think it's important what Kevin's saying, and it reminds me that during the Obama administration, the Pentagon authorized, because North Korea had sent up a satellite or something like that, and the U.S. went to the U.N. Security Council, got more sanctions on North Korea. But the U.S. actually flew from Nebraska B-1 or B-2 bombers, the most sophisticated part of that leg of the nuclear program.
Yes.
In other words, air-based nuclear capability. They flew it all the way from Nebraska, simulated the dropping of nuclear bombs on Korea, and then flew all the way back at the cost of like many, many millions of dollars.
Sure.
Because
mm-hmm.
it was such a, you know, it didn't stop for refueling. They were demonstrating to North Korea, we can hit you from all places, from South Korea, from Guam, from our bases in Japan, even from Nebraska, and simulating the destruction of the country. I mean, can you imagine if the shoe was on the other foot?
Well, remember, it actually was on the other foot, at least by way of propaganda. People went crazy in Washington when the North Koreans released a video, a made-up video, showing bombs exploding over New York and Washington. They went crazy, like it was an actual attack on the United States. Well, the truth is that we do the same kind of thing to them all the time.
Except not a video. They were actually flying a plane.
This was an actual flight of a B-1 stealth bomber. As you said, Brian, one of the most sophisticated weapons that's ever been invented by man. Flew it all the way there and all the way back after simulating its dropping of nuclear weapons.
When did they do that?
That was during the Obama administration, 2014, 2015, something like that. Kevin Camps, you know, it also reminds us what Daniel Ellsberg wrote in his book and said on this show, and that you've quoted on this show, that the U.S. doesn't have to drop nuclear bombs to employ and use nuclear bombs because they're terror weapons.
Yeah, his analogy was the metaphor of a bank robber with a gun in his hand demanding the money. You know, he might not pull the trigger, but he's using the gun to get the money. So the U.S., a mainstay of U.S. Defense policy, so-called, is to, you know, threaten the world with nuclear annihilation. And Trump got explicit about it with North Korea, of course, on the floor of the United Nations, incredibly enough. You know, I just wanted to put out there that there's a great watchdog group in Nebraska called Nebraskans for Peace, and they really do keep an eye on Strategic Air Command. And one real highlight for me was attending a 2003 rally and conference in Omaha where Nebraskans for Peace hosted, and it was in response to the George W. Bush administration holding a usable nuclear weapons summit at Strategic Air Command. So it was a real show of force by the peace movement to let the George W. Bush administration know that they were being watched and that there was resistance to this insane idea.
That's great to know about a grassroots organization in Nebraska who's working towards peace. That's fantastic.
I'm looking at their website right now. People can go to it, NebraskansForPeace.org, NebraskansForPeace.org. We're talking to Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the Organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read about what they're doing and get involved with this issue with the organization by going to their website, signing up to get their email announcements. That's beyondnuclear.org.
Brian, I have a question for you as someone who was at the Singapore summit and someone who's worked with and studied Korea for a long time. The way I see it, the Singapore summit agreement that you read just now with the 4 points, point two is about peace on the Korean Peninsula. And both Koreas have been working really, really hard on that. They've been meeting multiple times. They've had both heads of state actually meet, but also lots of officials in talking through what peace can look like. I think both leaders clearly want peace. There's also been moves toward denuclearization, at least on the North Korean side. We just talked about inspectors coming into their main base of operations for nuclear facilities, and there have been a number of other things that they've done as well. Point four is about remains being given back to the U.S., some of which have been done already. It really feels to me, and I'm not the expert, so what do you think? Does it feel like point one is the main one that has been left out a little bit? We've had a lot of canceled talks. I'm hoping that you know, reignites and that there are more talks, but it seems like the U.S. so far has been the only one dragging their feet.
Number one point is the linchpin, and that's why it's number one. It's number one because the North Koreans undoubtedly insisted that this doesn't come from Trump. This comes from them, and Trump agreed to it. The reason this is number one for them is that the North Koreans have made it clear that they will not disarm themselves, including they will not get rid of their nuclear weapons, unless they feel that the threat of war from the United States has ended. Now, the threat of war is not an abstraction for them. The Encyclopedia Britannica 1967 edition said that between 4 to 5 million Koreans died during that period of the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, who would not have otherwise died. That was about 20-25% of the population. I traveled a lot in North and South Korea 10-15 years ago, and I was collecting video testimony of survivors of the Korean War on both sides of the 38th parallel. And I can tell you, their testimonies are the same. The Korean people are telling the same kinds of stories, the same kind of horrific stories. This is so deeply ingrained in Korean psyche and thinking and culture. Without peace, nothing else really exists. And so what they're saying at the Singapore summit is, yes, we can work towards denuclearization, but we have to be guaranteed peace. And the guarantee has to come from the United States. It can't come from Moscow. It can't come from Beijing. It can't come from Seoul. Can't come even from Tokyo. Only Washington can give that. And I believe that's why they're actually very sincere about point number one. And you know what, Kevin? Why shouldn't point number one be the basis for the relations between all countries and all peoples? Like, yes, let's commit to establishing peaceful relations.
Well, that historic context you give is so important to all of this. I remember the book by Joe Gershon, Empire and the Bomb, and there was at least one instance of a threat to use nuclear weapons by the United States during the Korean War. I think there might have been multiple threats to do so. So here we are all these decades later, and we're not out of the woods yet on this nightmare scenario.
Yeah. Let's go on, Nicole. Time is going fast. Let's go to a couple other stories.
It always does. Kevin, there's a really interesting, and I don't know, I guess it's just interesting, this piece in TaiwanNews.com. A professor, Min Li is a nuclear engineering professor at National Tsinghua University, and he came out against denuclearization by Taiwan. They were trying to get rid of all their nuclear power plants by 2025. And this professor came out against, you know, this referendum and wrote a new referendum, essentially trying to reestablish all of these nuclear power plants, and has come out with some really strange statements. He said that the Three Mile Island accident was, quote, 40 years ago, and that changes have been made since. As for Chernobyl, Lee said the design of the reactor was different from what's used in Taiwan and said, quote, what happened in Chernobyl will not happen here. And then he talked about Fukushima and said that, and this is not a quote, but it's part of the Taiwan news article, the kind of massive tsunami that struck Fukushima would not occur in Taiwan because the fault lines around Taiwan are at an angle to the coast, as opposed to them being parallel in Japan. I'm completely stunned by this because those are three major accidents, of course, but, you know, we've detailed on the show for what the 8 months it's been on, all of the dangers and all of the near misses and all of the things that have happened that have been covered up and all of the corruption in these sorts of places. And it's just completely confusing to me. Can you tell us more about this?
Well, that's an excellent article you referenced there because it really critiqued this nuclear engineer's positions. The bad news is that his referendum reversing the nuclear abolition push succeeded. And so the long struggle against nuclear power in Taiwan continues. The good news is that the sitting government, the elected government, is anti-nuclear by popular demand, that it be. But this referendum sets that back. And it's a part of the deception that we see here in the United States, too. These false claims, I mean, the article really rebutted the notion that tsunamis are not to be worried about. In fact, the very locations of the nuclear power plants in Taiwan have been hit by massive tsunamis. One was 90 feet tall. Granted, it was in the 1700s. I think it was 1781. But as shown in Japan, you know, maybe a century or even a millennia will pass without a massive tsunami. But when it does hit on March 11th of 2011, you're having a world-changing nuclear power catastrophe at Fukushima. So, you know, this is a setback in Taiwan for nuclear abolition by 2025. But hopefully with the growth by leaps and bounds of renewables in Taiwan, including ocean-based renewables, it'll just outcompete nuclear power in the marketplace. And these, you know, dangerously old reactors in Taiwan, most of which date back to Three Mile Island era technology and design, will simply be phased out.
Well, that's a hopeful explanation. I'm still honestly, I mean, it feels incredibly irresponsible to use a position of power like that. But in our last 3 minutes, I also really want to get to the Senate panel advancing Trump's energy nominee. I don't know much about the energy nominee. What do you know? What's going on?
Well, McNamee is a real Trumpian kind of guy. He was in favor of the coal and nuclear bailouts that we've talked about in the past. And the Democrats really put up some resistance in the last week because a video emerged from just a few months back where this nominee was talking about coal being essential to the American way of life and renewables not meshing with the physics of the electric grid, which are all very objectionable because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is supposed to be fuel neutral. It's not supposed to take favorable positions towards fossil fuels or towards nuclear. It's supposed to be a free market kind of decision-making body. And here this guy, who I would say passed by a party-line vote in the Energy and Natural Resources Confirmation Committee hearing, but unfortunately, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, yet again, voted with the Republicans. So it was a 13-10 vote to advance this nominee's confirmation, and now it goes to the Senate floor. Well, it will undoubtedly pass with the Republican majority. And we're going to have a FERC commissioner who thinks that renewables are physically incompatible with the electric grid, which is a falsehood, and thinks that coal and apparently nuclear are essential to the American way of life.
To remind our listeners, Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, also voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. This article and these comments really remind me of the article we just talked about the Taiwanese professor Min Lee, who said really irresponsible things that were, you know, totally wrong. Min Lee also talked about how the policy that had been created by numerous people, this was one guy saying this, the policy that had been created by numerous people in Taiwan to encourage and use renewables by, you know, something like 20% of their energy in the next 10 years was not possible. But we know, I don't know the specifics about Taiwan, but similarly here, we know that renewables work. We've seen them work. They make a lot more sense. And I know you've talked in the past about why they make more sense, not just for getting green energy as a bigger part of our energy, but also, you know, to decentralize energy sources, as you've talked about before. We've got just 1 minute left, Kevin, if you want to close up.
Well, when you put the foxes in charge of the henhouse, guess what happens? I mean, yeah, like you said, a country like Germany, the fourth largest economy on the planet, is turning in a big way to renewables. It's phasing out nuclear power by 2022. It's cutting its emissions of natural gas and coal and oil, greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere by 85% levels. It's doing so by implementing renewable energy and energy efficiency. So if the fourth largest economy in the world with very limited land mass at a northern latitude can accomplish that, so can a country like Taiwan with immense ocean resources. And then the U.S., probably with the best renewable resources in the world, could do it too.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. Learn about what they do. Join them. Get involved with the organization. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.